It's a Percussion Podcast. We're calling this episode 239, and you might notice it's an early release. There's several episodes still to come, and we're doing this early though just because of some current events. And the current event I really want to talk about today is that the Supreme Court just ruled that sexual orientation and gender identity is protected characteristics under the Civil Rights Act. And our guest today is my dear sister, Allie Martin, back on the show, who we talked mostly about education and being a vice principal and all the things that she does with young kids. And we probably talked a little bit way long ago about all the active campaigning and things she's done over the years. I've just watched her little by little, like, actually play a role in this little victory. And she's going to totally undersell this. And I know I'll have to dig it out of her to kind of brag about this a little bit, but it's such a frustrating time we're living in right now with, I mean, just like our Facebook and Instagram feeds are just full of lots of outrage and people spreading a lot of opinion, but it's so hard to know what to do. And I've really watched my big sister like go and do something and get something done. So I just want to brag about it. And I got really excited when I saw this this little news item. And I said, Allie, let's get together and please tell us all about this. And if you're a new listener and you're wondering what the heck this is doing on this podcast, well, you just haven't been keeping up with us, and that's fine. But yeah, we've talked a lot about representation. We've talked a lot about gender and sexual orientation rights, all these things over the years, which of course a lot of musicians are very interested in supporting. So anyway, Allie Martin, welcome back to the show. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. Thank you for having me, though.
Yeah, sure. So listen, like, why don't you, and by the way, I should say my regular co-host crew is here, Ben Charles, Ksenia Komjanovic, and Carly Vigna. Thanks so much for joining like in 30 minutes notice and all showing up and being excited about this. But Allie, like, what does this law mean now? And what did it mean before when they said, okay, we're now interpreting this part of the law to now include this and this and that? What's different now?
Yeah, so, you know, I think what came up when the Supreme Court announced this, and let me tell you, I woke up this morning to a text from my friend that just said, call me, and then a missed call from him, and I was like freaked out because I was not expecting that this decision was going to come out today. That's not where my mind was. I thought there was some sort of terrible problem. And then I called him and he was like, have you seen the news? I was like, no, I'm like laying in bed right now. Like I just got your text and didn't do anything. And then he was like, we won the Supreme Court. Like employment discrimination is gone, which is huge. It's a really big deal. It's and I don't want to undersell it at all because this is a really like long, hard battle that just got won. Essentially what it means is, you know, until today, 26 states in the US, it was still legal to be fired for being gay or for being transgender. So something that was happening a lot across the US is people would get married on the weekend and then they'd go to their HR department on Monday morning to file for shared benefits, which all married couples are entitled to have, and they'd get fired for being gay. So marriage isn't really, you know, protected if people are being fired when they get married, because then they're being out at their work. So this Supreme Court case says that it is no longer illegal to fire somebody solely on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, along with all the other things that you're protected against being fired for, like race, religion, age, disability, that sort of thing.
Cool. Well, I definitely want to get to what you did over the years, and that's really why you're here. But I think Ben might have a question.
Yeah, and I think we might have talked about this on the episode many moons ago, but it might be in order to have a quick refresher. One thing that interests me is the concept of being an ally. And I think it's very easy, in a sense, to be, I'll call it a bandwagon ally. Like, oh yeah, I've got a gay friend, sure. Yeah, I can, you know, get behind that.
But that's what I am, Ben. That's
but like, to actually, you know, put your foot out in front and, you know, I think it's safe to say in your case, you've actually done quite a bit more work for the gay community than a lot of gay people. And so could you tell us, like, what made you, I hate to like use this expression, but what made you get into that in the beginning?
Sure. I mean, it's a fair question, and I get asked that a lot. So I'm straight, cisgender, female, person. And I think, for me, it kind of started, like, Casey and I were raised by a dad who often talked about his involvement in the civil rights movement in the South growing up. He grew up in the segregated South, and he talked with a lot of pride about, like, having a cross burned on his lawn because of some of the activism. Did you not know that, Casey?
Two crosses.
Two. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's what, so, these were the stories that we were told growing up, and for me, it instilled a sense of desire to be active and to be an activist. Reading the chat, which I shouldn't do while we're doing this. 1942 is when my dad was born, I believe.
That's what I was going to guess next. I said 1785 or something.
So we were brought up with that kind of sense of ethics. And then when I started teaching, my first year teaching, I had this experience where I took a sick day, and I came back the next day, and the students were really upset, and they told me that the sub was just the worst ever, which kids always say when you come back from a sick day. But what I didn't realize, and what they told me, was that the sub was the worst ever because he had openly made fun of one of my students and one of their classmates for being gay. And when that student left the room, without knowing that the sub was being critical of him, he then, like, made really awful statements to the rest of the class about, like, how he would kill himself if he had a son like that, or just horrible, horrible things. And what I realized is that it didn't really matter what I did as a classroom teacher, because I wouldn't ever create a world in which my students felt safe if I only, like, limited my actions to my classroom. So that led me to kind of push for larger changes, like, outside of just my classroom. And so as I kind of, like, followed that path, it led me, into doing more activism at my school. And then I started to volunteer with HRC because I was kind of just looking for some way to get involved on a little bit larger scale, and really enjoyed working with HRC, and became a member of the Board of Governors this year, and, took on, like, a greater leadership role, which has been, like, really fulfilling for me. So it's just something I've really enjoyed, and it's come to mean a lot to me, because even though it didn't start out as, like, a personal thing, like I now see it as that, and I see very much, like, my liberation tied up in the LGBTQ community, because, quite frankly, like, if we're going to discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity, then, we're also going to discriminate against people who are presenting in, like, traditional methods of gender performance, which, as, like, a female leader, has been something that's always held me back a little bit and caused some issues. And I know, female percussionists also deal with those same kinds of struggles. And I think it has a lot to do with, like, inherent sexism and inherent, like, feelings about how we have to perform our gender, which is what the Supreme Court talked about today.
Yeah, and HRC, oh, sorry, Ben, just for anyone who might not know, HRC stands for the Human Rights Campaign. That's all. What, Ben?
Yeah, well, I was just going to add that it's been interesting for me with the whole, like, the recent uptick in the Black Lives Matter movement. And I saw someone on social media explain it as, it's not a political issue. It's a human rights issue. And, like, it seems like when you put it that way, it's like, of course you should be behind this. It's not a question. And I don't know if anyone else here has seen the Sacha Baron Cohen series, Who is America? Is anyone familiar with that? So this is the same guy that did Borat and Bruno. It's actually, I think, just like a really, I mean, it's funny. It's very funny, but it's a really insightful look into, like, just America from, quite frankly, an outsider's perspective. And I think it's the first episode, and pardon me for being ridiculous for a minute, but he one of his characters in the show establishes this program called Kinderguardians. And it's, he's going around to congressmen and saying, you know, in Israel, we have this problem called Kinderguardians, and we're working on, you know, getting guns into hands of children from 16 down to the age of, I think it's four, or maybe it's three.
It's and he's, ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, he's just, you know, they're making a how to use a gun video for children. I mean, it's like, it's obviously, it's just complete satire of our political system. But then he goes to congressmen and asks them if they'll back it. And it shows one Republican congressman, and he's like, okay, hold on. You think you're going to come into my office and tell me a little bit of a program about arming four-year-olds, and I'm immediately going to, you know, get behind it and back it? Like, no, thank you very much. Have a good day. And then immediately after that, it cuts to three or four other prominent members of Congress that are just immediately jump behind this program. And he says that the reason he included that first one is he wanted to show, like, it's a choice. Like, you don't have to, like, toe the party line. You don't have to just jump behind any ridiculous idea because it's, you know, somehow related to what your party thinks. And I think it was before we were recording, but Ali mentioned that she had talked to, I think not directly Mitt Romney, but Mitt Romney's people. And Mitt Romney is a very prominent Republican that I'm, like, very pleased to see has taken a very progressive stance on some of these human rights issues, like the Black Lives Matter movement, and as far as I can tell, the you know, human rights campaign sort of issues. So yeah, I think it's one of those things that, you know, at this point in history, if you're wavering on, like, oh, I don't know if I should support this, it's not a political issue. It's not like an issue of who should we be taxing or anything like that. It's literally human rights. It's kind of like, how can you, I don't understand how someone cannot get behind that at this point in history. Sorry for my long ramble, but I just wanted to add my two cents here.
I of course, I agree with Ben, and I want to ask Ali, maybe, like, is it ever a challenge when you're trying to do this human rights effort, that because it has become politicized and people do use these events for political reasons, does that get in the way? Does that make it, like, way harder to do things?
I mean, I think, you know, it's obviously, you know, it's going to be an issue. Part of it is in how you talk about it, right? You know, like Ben said, you know, it's not an issue of, like, let's just get a bunch of Democrats elected. Like, first of all, like, the Democrats weren't behind this until recently anyway.
Right.
So, you know, like, it's not a unique issue to Republicans. But I think, you know, the bigger issue is it does seem to be something that a lot of people don't see as impacting them, or only impacting them from, like, a freedom of religion way. So that seems to be the big argument that I hear against it is, you know, if we allow people to use the restroom in a public building, then you've somehow violated my religious freedom. And that's the argument that Mike Lee's office made to us when we went there to talk to them. And, you know, that's been an argument that's been made for so long, and it's so non-unique. You know, this was the argument that was made against civil rights. You know, we had segregated bathrooms, you know, for Black people and for white people. And the argument that, you know, if you allowed Black people into a white bathroom or vice versa, that there would be some sort of, like, you know, moral crumbling of our society was the foundation of that argument for segregation. And so now we see the exact same arguments being made against transgender people and being made by essentially the same people, right? So once folks begin to see it as an issue that affects them personally, then I think that there is a really big mind shift. And that comes from either knowing somebody who's LGBTQ, you know, loving somebody who's LGBTQ, because we all have people in our lives who are. We just might not all know it yet.
Right.
But then the other thing is understanding, you know, that same, you know, the poem from the Holocaust about first they came, for the Jews and I wasn't Jew, right? You know, like that same thing, like, okay, like if we're going to allow them to openly discriminate against one group of people, then we're going to allow them to openly discriminate against any group of people because no one's safe at that point.
So Ali, can you kind of trace the types of actions that you and other people like you have been doing over the years? Because I remember you told me about this years ago and I didn't even know. I was like, what? You can't get fired for being gay. What do you mean? And then you told me like, no. There's plenty of places and private businesses and depending on where you work. Oh yeah, there's lots and lots of ways. And it would probably be worth at some point for you to just kind of elaborate a little bit on how pervasive this could be, how easily it could have been to have been fired. I think you gave us one example, but maybe first, if you could tell, kind of trace the steps that led to this and what were the types of things that people like yourself did that ultimately got this cool victory?
Okay. So I'm going to geek out on you a little bit there.
Yeah. And so brag if you would. I mean, I think it's hard to brag.
Cut this down if you want. I mean, I'll start it with, like, I'll start my sense of the history. And I know there's definitely stuff before this, but I'll start it with, like, the AIDS epidemic or the AIDS crisis, the 1980s. Because what you saw there was you saw people dying of a disease that they didn't understand and that nobody was really addressing publicly. So it was super scary. And I think, you know, if anybody remembers back to February and March in this country with COVID, you know, they have a sense of what it might have been like to be a gay person in the 1980s. But what you also saw was you saw that people who had, you know, really close relationships with other people, you know, the equivalent of a marriage, being denied access to their partners at the end of life, being denied the ability to plan a funeral or to you know, follow through with like final wishes because they didn't have legal right to marriage. And, you know, marriage, it, you know, that's when we started to see that marriage is more than just, you know, a religious sacrament. It's a legal contract that allows you to make decisions for your partner when they're unable to, that allows you to inherit things from your partner and to take care of them after your death. So people, you know, people's lives are being destroyed not only because of AIDS, but also because of the lack of marriage. So that kind of prompted, you know, a push for marriage and civil unions and things like that. And when marriage was legalized, you know, only a few years ago, I think a lot of people thought like, well, like we're done with that. Like it's all over now. We did it. In much the same way that people thought like racism was solved when we elected Obama, our president, you know, and far from it, right? Like it turns out it takes more than that.
Right. Yeah.
So this really hard, long battle for marriage, which gained a lot of public attention and a lot of public support, you know, was one, and then people walked away a bit from the issue. And I feel like a lot of us were kind of still scrambling to say like, wait, like marriage was just the first step. Because when you start to look at like what else comes, like I said, like married on Sunday, fired on Monday became a really common problem. But there are other issues too. So let's say you get married and then you wanna go on a honeymoon, which most people do, right? You know, there are still 26 states in the U.S. where you can legally be denied public accommodations and housing as a result of being gay or being transgender. So, you know, my husband and I can travel anywhere in the U.S. and expect to be able to get a hotel room, but that's not true if I had a wife, right? Or, if I presented as somebody who was more gender fluid, they could legally deny that to me. So that still has not been addressed by the federal government and is up to like on a state-by-state basis whether or not they pass non-discrimination laws. Utah is a really unique example of like the one of the only red states. We're the first red state to pass a legally binding non-discrimination law. And we're also the first state to pass it by referendum. Like we voted in favor of this. You get a whole bunch of really conservative Mormon Republicans who voted in favor of non-discrimination law that protects LGBTQ people from discrimination in employment and in housing in Utah. And that was proactively done. But the way that we were able to pass that is because of something that we call the Utah Compromise, which gives the ability for people to deny or to discriminate based on religious need or whatever. So like BYU, the religious university, can still discriminate in their housing because that's part of their honor code. And the LDS church can still discriminate in their employment practices because that's part of their religious belief. But more importantly, people who rent to fewer than 50 tenants. So people who don't own like giant apartment buildings, but I just like rent my basement apartment, or I just have like a couple of houses that I own. This is like the college town, you know, there's a lot of that going on. They can also discriminate. So it's really only like the big apartment buildings that where the protections exist in Utah. But anyway, so currently in the legislative branch, right? So everything that happened because of Supreme Court cases, because, you know, lawsuits were brought. The government didn't just decide this, like the Supreme Court had to hear a case and make this decision. But the legislative branch has a bill that passed the House of Representatives that is stalled in the Senate and is most likely not going to make it out of the Senate, but it's called the Equality Act, and it solves a lot of these problems. It doesn't solve everything, but it solves a lot of these problems because it says not only would nationwide employment discrimination be made illegal, but it would also be illegal to discriminate on the basis of like housing, credit, education, jury service, public spaces, public services, federally funded programs, such as hospitals and colleges and adoptions, and public accommodations like stores, restaurants, and hotels. So all of those things currently aren't protected against discrimination except for employment now starting today. So, you know, if I go into a diner in one of the 26 states, I won't name anything because that just seems mean at that point, because I don't live in one of those states, luckily. But if I go into a diner, why shouldn't I?
Do I live in one of those states?
I believe Virginia just passed non-discrimination like a couple months ago.
I have a feeling Ben and Ksenia live in one of the 26 states.
Yeah, one of those 26 states is a really, really big state and accounts for about like a third of the U.S. population, something huge like that. But anyway, like none of those protections are still given. So there is still a battle to be fought. The other thing that still needs to be fought and that still has not been solved is healthcare. Shocking that that's still a mess in this country. But Obama did a really cool thing when he was able to get the Affordable Care Act passed. There's a component of the Affordable Care Act called Section 1557, which basically guaranteed that anything that was covered for one person had to be covered for anybody regardless of sex. And the Obama administration did what the Supreme Court did today, which was define sex as including sexual orientation and gender identity, because both of the discrimination around both of those things is on the basis of somebody's sex, right? I'm not performing female if I am with another woman, so therefore I'm being discriminated. If you discriminate against me because I'm a lesbian, you're discriminating against me on the basis of my sex, because if I was a man and I was with a woman, then you wouldn't, right? So that's kind of the logic that the court used. So anyway, 1557 of the Affordable Care Act says that, like, if, for example, I as a cisgendered woman can get hormone therapy to cover like menopause or chemotherapy or whatever, you know, to help me with that, then a transgender person should be able to also have hormone therapy covered to treat them for whatever, you know, they need in order to make their body feel the way that they want their body to feel, right? There's no, you know, I'm not going to die if I don't get hormone therapy, but my insurance will cover it. So they should cover it for a transgender person as well. You know, they would cover reconstructive breast surgery for me after, you know, like a cancer treatment, then they should cover reconstructive breast surgery for anybody for whatever reason, you know, at that they have that makes them, you know, need that. So that was in place for about a year, and then Trump came into office and he just kind of pressed pause on it. Like, we didn't really know for sure whether or not it was going to be enforced or not, but insurance companies just kind of backed away from it, and nobody, the government didn't tell them that they couldn't do that. So they just kind of started walking away from it. And then on, was it Friday, Thursday? It was on the anniversary of the Pulse shooting, the nightclub shooting where in Orlando where 49 people were killed, targeted because they were considered to be really easily victimized because of their LGBTQ and because they were mostly people of color. This was Latinx night at the Pulse gay club. But anyway, on that day, on the anniversary of that shooting, Trump announced that he was officially reversing the 1557 and would not enforce that anymore as part of the Affordable Care Act.
Do you think he took away? Purpose? Oh, sorry. Do you think he did that on purpose, or do you think he's just an idiot?
I don't know. I think maybe gay people were on his mind at that moment because somebody mentioned Pulse, and so he decided to just.
Right. Yeah, I guess it's hard to know, and I guess it doesn't matter a whole lot. But yeah, was he trying to be insulting, or is he just a dumbass, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know. But yeah. Okay. So right now, you know, it's not only is it legal to be discriminated against, you know, in terms of being admitted to a hospital and such, but also your insurance can deny you coverage for things that they wouldn't deny somebody else coverage for based solely on the fact that it's related to somebody being transgender, which is completely legal right now in this country.
I think generally people don't realize the scope, how far discrimination goes. You know, that they think it goes as far as marriage, or they don't realize just how widespread it really is. But I feel like a lot of people, if they did know, they would feel a little differently. Sorry, but
yeah, I think
still showing us the path to this.
Oh, well, I mean, that pretty much brings us up to present day. I was going to say, though, I think one thing that happens a lot is people don't realize that these discriminations exist until they are victims of them. And the best example that I have is, you know, I'm the parent of a 14-year-old. You know, I know a lot of people who are also parents of a 14-year-old or that general age. And I like to walk them through the scenario. Imagine that your child comes to you and they're crying and they're telling you that they don't want to live anymore and that they have, you know, hurt themselves or whatever. You know, you want to do whatever you can to protect your child. And so you might, you know, try to find them a psychologist because that's something that a parent would want to do to help their child. And, you know, if you're like most Americans, you've got to get that pre-approved by your insurance and you've got to, you know, jump through some hoops and you can't go to anybody. They've got to be in your network, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So you do all of that and you send your kid to the psychologist and, you know, they meet with them and things start to get better. And then you realize that, none of your bills are going to be paid by your insurance. And so you're on the hook for the $100-$200 an hour that the psychologist is charging. And the reason why is because your child has gender dysphoria, which is a really, you know, common issue for transgender people, especially youth. And it's a true psychological illness. It has to do with living in a society that discriminates against people on the basis of their gender identity. And it's something that people, you know, die from, but it's completely legal for insurance companies to deny coverage for that, even though the psychologist would be covered for any other reason. You know, you could go to that same psychologist for depression or for PTSD or for anorexia or any other thing, but solely based on the diagnosis of gender dysphoria, that psychologist can be denied by your insurance, which is tragic and which prevents people from accessing care that they need and which, you know, further stigmatizes people and you know, makes them feel hopeless. And I don't think that there are many people in America who would want that to happen. Who, I don't think there are many people in America who think that it's okay that that's going on. But like you said, I don't think that most people know that it's going on. And I don't think that most people understand how hard it's going to affect them when their kid comes to them and it is like their family that's being impacted by it.
It's one of those things, I mean, like buried in every one of these issues is all this nuance and subtlety and details. And I know I've said it so many times on the show before, but it's just like, you have to get beyond the headline. And we live in such a world where if it doesn't fit in a quick headline, it's too hard to post on social media. And like, how many things do you actually, you know, read all of that you clicked like on, and how many of those rabbit holes do you actually go all the way down? And it's just, it's such a commitment, but it's really, really important. I think Ben has something to add, then Ksenia.
Ksenia first. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, thanks so much for sharing, Ellie. It's so inspiring to hear you talk. And it's so amazing to see a person who knows how to get places and that you move and create this new environment for people. It's really incredible. I was going to ask you, because I've been reading a lot of David Foster Wallace recently, and he really likes to, or used to, I guess, he liked to point out how, especially in the US, because that's the culture that he observed most, people are really, how should I say that, they do not wish to invest time into researching about politics. You know, and come elections, people base their opinion on advertisements that they see or whatever today would be clickbait. And what would the rest of us, what would you say are some good resources? Perhaps you could share those with Casey later, we could link them up. But for any of us who do want to mobilize and do things more, where should we go? How should we start getting educated? You know, because all that the youth is taught to do is to repost a story. And that means that you are an ally and that's enough.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that keeps coming up recently is, you know, there's this sense of like who's getting coverage in the media and who's not. We've seen, you know, just absolutely horrific examples of police brutality against, you know, Black men and women. We know that trans Black people, men, women, and everything in between are the most likely to be brutalized by both police and society in general. You know, remembering that and keeping that in mind, I think is helpful. It complicates the issue so much. And you're right, like we love things to be really simple. We don't like to have to keep layering on all of these other things, but the idea that these are intersectional issues and that we live in an intersectional world. There's no such thing as a Black issue that's not also a queer issue, that's not also a gender issue, that's not also a religious issue. You know, there's no such thing as a female issue. You know, like feminism can't only include cisgendered women, or else we'll never make any progress. And so I think, you know, being inclusive and looking around any room and thinking like who's here and who's not here and what can I do as a person who's in the room to make this room more accessible to other people. You know, there's even been talk about like, well, how do we make protests easier for people who, you know, are in wheelchairs or for people who are deaf and, you know, and can't hear the chant, you know, things like that. There's so many different people in the world, and to try to think about everybody at any given time is really overwhelming, and we all mess up. So I think that, you know, part of it too is just acknowledging that like no one is perfect. We all have implicit biases that we, you know, are that we're gonna have to deal with. And so allowing other people to call you on them and to call other people out without, you know, excluding them or alienating them is really important. But, you know, I think that's really important. And I think that if there's anybody who gets it better than most, it's young people. I think that they've grown up in a world in which labels have become much less meaningful for them than they were for us. but there's also, you know, I mean, there's still like that youth that, you know, we have to work together to get past and to make sure, you know, things are moving forward in a direction that makes sure that we bring everybody with us.
Yeah, Carly, I think.
Yeah, Ali, I just want to say thank you so much for all the work that you're doing on this front. And also, I know that we all teach, and many of our listeners are teachers or students or involved in education in some way. What do you see as the responsibility or ideas for what we can do as teachers and facilitators of equality and better opportunity?
Yeah, I love that. That's where I am too. You know, I work in K-12 schools. And I was actually thinking about that after Casey asked me to do this earlier today. I was like thinking about the unique issues that I think music teachers face in particular. And there were a couple of things that came to mind. One of them, I think, is, you know, especially with choir, there are just like the little issues of like uniforms or outfits. I don't know what, they're not costumes, but you know, there's a really strict gender like binary in the choir community. I know I have friends who are in that community that talk to me about it. But you know, those are things that I think a lot of people are fine to address them if they're brought up. But if you don't proactively address them in advance, then you're less likely to need to address them when they come up, because kids will just self-select out of those programs and you're going to lose kids in advance.
If I could jump in, I just wanted to add something. And at Tarleton, in our music major handbook, we have guidelines for concert dress. And it says like men, you know, tuxedo, you know, like list for like concert, like a concert performance, a recital performance, you know, junior and senior, whatever. And this is not my original idea, but I had heard this and I brought it up in a faculty meeting. Why does it have to say male and female? Why can't we just have option one, option two? And so we actually changed that language in our handbook. And it's like, or like, if you weren't even looking for the, you know, quote unquote political issue of it, like, not that I think it's a political issue, but it probably wouldn't even strike you as odd that it doesn't say men and women. It's just, oh, there's these
right.
options. Yeah. Like, and that's like something so easy that just like flies under the radar, but if that means something to you, then it's there, you know. It's so easy and non-explosive, I guess. I don't know.
No, I mean, that's exactly it. And what we know is people have they do something that we call scanning for safety, and we all do it to a certain extent, but especially when you feel like you're in a room that's not safe, or you're entering an environment that you're unsure of, people will scan for safety. So what you're doing is you're looking for clues that this is a place that you're either safe or you're not safe. Think about like when you go to a party and you don't know anybody, you're the only one there. First thing you do is scan the room and look for people who you might know, who you didn't know were there, people who look like you, people who are speaking your language, people who are talking about things that you know about or are interested in about, right? Like those are all ways that we scan for safety. And people who are further marginalized, who especially like LGBTQ kids, are gonna walk into a classroom and immediately scan for safety. They're gonna look for things like, does the teacher have a poster on their wall that says that they are supportive of LGBTQ people, right? You know, I'm looking for rainbows. I'm looking for, you know, like anything like that, any sort of like a safe sign of safety. They're gonna look through things like dress codes and other policies with, you know, like a much different lens than somebody who doesn't have those concerns is gonna. So they're gonna pick up on those things that you talked about, Ben, that somebody else might not even notice. And even like simple things like, you know, your disclosure statement or, you know, whatever permission forms you're sending home, like does it have a line for mom and dad, or does it have a line for like parent/guardian? You know, like those are the kinds of things that are good practice for all kids, you know, regardless of gender identity or sexual orientation, but are really good ways to show that you're safe. I think another thing that comes up a lot in music is there's some travel involved usually. So proactively thinking about how you're gonna address hotel rooms or other things like that could be really important. There are a lot of different guidelines out there based on, you know, like different states and stuff. But if you take that fear off the table initially for a child, then they're more likely to take the risk of coming, you know, into your program. But if they know that that's going to be something that's going to come up later and that they're going to have to be the ones to initiate that conversation or address that, then the chances are that they're not going to take that risk and that they're just going to like hold back and not join in. So, you know, writing things like that up and putting them out there proactively is really important. And I think just in general, the most important thing for all educators to do is to proactively come out as an ally, which means that you might feel uncomfortable sometimes talking about how you're an ally and how and what that means to you, but you're taking that pressure off of a child who would be even more uncomfortable coming out to you initially, right? So if they know it's not going to be an issue for you, then you can, you know, do that. You can do that for them. And so one thing that I do is I make sure I put my pronouns on my email signatures and my, you know, anything like that, because that's a sign to other people that I'm an ally and that, you know, I'm open to having a conversation about gender identity. And instead of just asking a kid to identify their pronouns for me, if I'm going to be up, you know, open and upfront initially, then that might open that conversation for them later on.
Allie, school me on something real quick regarding that, because I've chosen not to do that yet, and a big part of me is undecided. My initial thinking is like, well, maybe it's good to send a message to a kid like, hey, if they call you the wrong thing, that's okay. You know what I mean? Like that's been my feeling, and by not putting it there by my name, he, him. My thinking is, okay, well, I'm trying to show people that, like, hey, be strong, be brave, be courageous. If they call you the wrong thing, you know, I invite them to call me the wrong thing. It's okay. But like, what else is there to that? Or what should, or maybe I shouldn't do that.
I mean, I've definitely heard, you know, people who say the exact same thing that you do, and trans advocates who say the same thing. I don't think it's like a universally accepted practice. I think it's more common to use pronouns than not. Certainly most people would say that it's best practice. And I think that, you know, putting your pronouns out there doesn't necessarily take away the pain of being misgendered for somebody who's transgender. I think that all that it does is it acknowledges that gender identity is more complex than, you know, you and I certainly grew up believing. And so putting it out there is just a sign of allyship in my mind. You know, if I'm misgendered, like, that doesn't really bother me that much. It's, you know, it's okay. I'm going to get through my day. You know, I'm pretty resilient, and that's not an issue that I have to deal with very often. Mm-hmm. But I put my pronouns out there because I do understand that I don't want to misgender somebody else, because it does cause other people pain, and really intense pain that I can't understand as somebody who hasn't had to suffer through that. Mm-hmm. So me putting it out there is just kind of a way for like that scanning for safety. Of allowing somebody else to see, like, oh, this is someone who's thought about this, who knows about this, and maybe is going to be a safe person. A story that I tell in a lot of my trainings is one of my early years teaching, I just made a little sign that said something to the effect like, discriminatory language on the basis of like race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, like blah, 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 you know, like a, just a big list of things is not tolerated in this room. And it was a very wordy sign, and by no means was it, you know, like a landmark moment in any, you know, like classroom in America. I didn't think much of it. Like, kids would make comments every once in a while, but it wasn't like a big deal. And then one year I got an email from a kid I didn't teach, who I didn't know, who was a student at the high school where I taught. And he said, hey, you don't know me. You know, I wasn't your student, but I just want you to know I'm graduating now. And I used to walk past your classroom every day and see your sign and feel better, because I knew that there was somebody in the school who would support me or would have my back if I needed it. And it meant a lot to me that you hung that up, and I just wanted to let you know that. And for me, that was another like big moment in my career where I realized what a big difference those little things can make. So nobody had ever told me before that my sign mattered to them. And to be honest, like it wasn't something that I was like super proud of or anything. It was just kind of a thing that I hung in my classroom. And then I got that email and I realized that I was impacting people I didn't even know as a result of putting that out there and just hanging it on like the window of my classroom door. And that I think is one of those things that, you know, we should be doing in our classrooms. We should be proactively doing because you don't know what people are looking for. And it didn't hurt anybody that was up, but it did help somebody, which, you know, I wouldn't have realized, but, you know, definitely like gave me the kind of feedback that I needed to continue to do that work and to become more bold in that work as well.
And so many of us already feel that way. We just don't have a way of presenting it. You know, I've got an HRC sticker on my name tag outside my room, but I think a lot of people know what that is, but a lot of people probably don't, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. Cool. Ali, I think we went longer than we intended to, but I remember you kind of wanted to talk about, okay, this Supreme Court ruling was a nice victory, but there are some other things that we really need to still win. Can you tell us a summary of what those are?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big ones are the Equality Act and putting back into place Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act. Right now, the Equality Act is supported, like polls show that 70% of Americans, when asked about it, support the Equality Act. This is not an unpopular idea, and this is by no means controversial. If you ask people if you think that a hotel should be able to deny a night stay to a couple because they're gay, they will tell you, no, I don't think that a hotel should be able to do that. 70% of Americans support the Equality Act. Unfortunately, most members of the Senate do not support it. So the easy thing that anybody can do, particularly cisgendered straight people can do, is to write to their senators and say, I want you to support the Equality Act. I think that there are a lot of Republicans out there who are starting to realize that they're on the wrong side of history, and that a vote for the Equality Act is not going to vote them out of office. I think there are people who can flip on this issue and who would want to be, they would want to be seen as one of the people who voted in favor of the Civil Rights Act. So they should be one of the people who vote in favor of the Equality Act because it's essentially the same thing. So that's a big one. And I think that's something that a lot of people can put a small amount of effort. I know it's uncomfortable to write to senators. I hate it too. But, you know, once you do it, you realize it's really not that big a deal. An email and a really quick, you know, or a phone call would make a huge difference. The other thing, and you know, the Affordable Care Act is not something that most of our legislators have any control over, but it's something that our president does. So getting out there and voting in November and making sure that we have somebody in the executive branch who has a heart, who, you know, we can be proud of, would make a huge difference as well.
That's my latest fear. I get so angry when I see one of those like, hey, latest poll shows Trump's doing bad. No, he's not. He's doing good. No, we need to be like in emergency go vote mode. You know, it's like, this is exactly what happened last time. You know, all the reported polls were like, oh, there's no way he can win. And he's no good grounds for, it's like, wait, that all turned out to be false. Like, you know, we just really have to, there's kind of no choice. You got to go do it. Ben, I think you were going to wrap us up with a little something.
Yeah, I wanted to share a little something that I read online as well as a personal experience. And I will preface this by saying that a few episodes ago, when we were talking about Black Lives Matter, I mentioned that a long time ago, Megan Arends told us about when she was studying in Africa, they visited the site where slaves were taken from Africa and shipped, you know, to the Caribbean. And this is something that happened, I should have looked up the date, I believe it was around like the, 15th century, something like that. I mean, like hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And she said, you stood at this site and the only thing that you could think of was that this is where people lost their humanity. This is where an entire race of people was sold off to the rest of the world on the premise that they were less of human beings than other people. And I think there is very much a parallel in LGBT plus rights to that. And there's something people were asking about, like resources you can look at. If you're not familiar, there's something called the Trevor Project, which is a nonprofit that is basically, its mission is to help prevent suicide in LGBT plus youth. And so they have several statistics on their website, but I just pulled four in particular. And so I'll read these four. And as I read these, I would invite you to think about, is this a political issue or a human rights issue where I don't want to compromise the rights, or excuse me, the lives of youth? And so the four I wanted to read, and I'm reading directly, so it separates, in a sense, LGB people from transgender people, because I think that transgender people are even more likely to have suicidal tendencies. But anyway, the four facts that I just pulled off are: LGB youth seriously contemplate suicide at almost three times the rate of heterosexual youth. LGB youth are almost five times as likely to have attempted suicide compared to heterosexual youth. In a national study, 40% of transgender adults reported having made a suicide attempt. 92% of these individuals reported having attempted suicide before the age of 25. And the fourth fact is LGB youth who come from highly rejecting families are 8.4 times as likely to have attempted suicide as LGB peers who reported no or low levels of family rejection. And so, like I said, I think this comes back to the idea of dehumanizing people. And, you know, when you talk about, well, you have almost as many rights as other people, but you don't get these other protections, it really weighs on people. And for me, just my little anecdote of a personal experience, this has happened one time in my entire life. I can remember in, I think it was 2006, I was thinking about this earlier today, behind Kerr Hall at the University of North Texas, I was getting into a friend's car. And someone, I don't know who, but someone called me, this is the only time it's ever happened in my entire life, a faggot. And at that very moment, it stuck with me like for years to come. Like I felt like here I was, a student on, you know, music and academic scholarship that had so much interest in life and other people, was reduced to one small fact about myself. And it's not even something that I'm like ashamed of, but it's just like that there's so much more to me than that one aspect of me that I think that's almost uninteresting. So yeah, before you start thinking, well, you know, I have these religious grounds or whatever, I hope that anyone's moral compass would turn them toward trying to save the lives of compromised youth. So that's my little soapbox moment to end.
Awesome, Ben. Yeah. Wow. Cool. Hey, you guys, thanks so much for throwing this together with me and Allie. Like, you know, I hope you really feel like a personal success. I mean, as soon as I saw that post, I thought like, wow, Allie did it. that's like a little brother just like being excited. But that was like really my genuine thought, like Allie did it all her on her own. So anyway, it is like really, really cool. And yeah, thanks for throwing this together real quick. And Ksenia, Carly, Ben, good to see you as always. And okay, everybody, we'll after this episode, I think we'll be back on the regular release dates, at least episode order. So anyway, thanks everyone. Take care.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Allie.